This is Jim Ketterer here at WAMC with Ambassador Robert Gassende talking about his life and career working overseas in the United States Foreign Service and how that career intersected with so many elements of U.S. history, world history that were so crucial in the second half of the 20th century. Bob, when we ended the previous episode, we were talking about your time as a regional English language officer in Libya. And then you left Libya after about 2 years, and you moved to Somalia, a country that we will see will become important in your career again in more dramatic ways in the 1990s. But in the late 1960s, early 1970s, when you get to Somalia, what is your job and what's the lay of the land?
Well, we were in Somalia the first time for just about 2 years. 1 year under the old government and 1 year under the revolutionary government set up by Mohamed Siad Barre, a ruthless dictator who, unfortunately, the U.S. had supplied with all kinds of weaponry. And the first year was an absolute delight. We met dozens and dozens of Somalis. Again, I set up an English language teaching operation in Mogadishu. But when I got to Somalia, there was only one other American officer in the U.S. Information Service in Somalia, even though there were five positions. And what had happened was the place was so crazy that the other four officers had all found a way to get out of there and never come back again. But we liked it, and so we embarked on this very pleasant experience for a year, and then wham, the coup came. From there, Somalia became a kind of, outpost for communism, outpost for the Soviets. On the day of the coup, three Soviet warships hove to on the horizon just off the coast of Mogadishu. They couldn't come inshore because Mogadishu is a shallow water port. They couldn't get onshore. But they sent all kinds of troops, white Russian troops in uniform, to wander around Somalia in the midst of its coup.
In that first year, when you were setting up English language teaching programs, as I recall, you were also engaged in other aspects of cultural diplomacy, one of them being bringing American musical groups to perform in Somalia.
Yes. Part of what the U.S. Information Agency did in those days was a program called Arts America, where we tried to showcase American artistic performers and performance groups overseas. And we sent a largish group of dancers, believe it or not, to Somalia for a celebration.
I remember one of your stories being that one of these groups had one very specific request for you, that if they were going to continue their performances and they were going to be able to be the cultural diplomats you wanted them to be, they needed you to help them out.
They needed a case of gin.
Yes. And sometimes diplomacy takes on many different forms.
And they said, you don't want us performing without this case of gin.
Well, and so your job then was to find that case.
My job was to get that case of gin, which wasn't that difficult.
So you left in 1971 from Somalia. You would return later, and we will talk about that in a subsequent episode. And then you went to South Africa from there. We're going to talk about South Africa later because you were there multiple times, and it's easiest to combine them into one conversation.
Good.
So I think it's also important to just remind people the time period. You're talking about the Soviets showing up in Somalia, Mohamed Siad Barre. By the way, I saw Mohamed Siad Barre much later in the game when he had been ousted, and he was sort of floating around the world looking for his own safe landing spot, and he was... I saw him bellied up to a bar in Tangier, Morocco. So it's funny how these things go with dictators on the loose. So this was the time of the Cold War, and this was a time of intense American-Soviet competition in many ways, culturally, geostrategically, etc. And so one of the places you went to in the midst of this Cold War competition is right to the heart of it. You left Africa and you went to Poland.
Yes. The only time I really insisted on an assignment in the diplomatic service, most people think, you know, you ask for what you're going to get. You get into a long negotiation. I never did that. Only once did I ever insist on anything, and that was in 1963 when we were leaving Cape Town. I said—
73.
73, when we were leaving Cape Town. I said, you know, we've been in Africa a long time now. I think it would be good if we saw another part of the world. And I would like to serve in Central Europe. And I asked specifically for Poland, Romania, or Yugoslavia. And we were lucky enough to be assigned to Warsaw. So we went from Cape Town to Warsaw via Washington for 10 months of Polish language training.
That's another thing for people to keep in mind, is that the U.S. Diplomatic Corps takes the teaching of language seriously. We spend a lot of time, effort, and money teaching English around the world, but we also take it seriously that our diplomats should learn languages, and that particularly in the area of public diplomacy, you can be far more effective if you can speak and understand the language of the country that you happen to be going to. And so we have the Foreign Service Institute and various other ways that people learn these languages at a very high level, and not in an academic way. I mean, really to be used.
Yes. The cultural affairs job that I was going into in Warsaw was as the State Department and the U.S. Information Agency called it, a language-designated position. That meant that I had to have at least a 3+3+ in the language. That's a scale of 1 to 5 in reading and writing and understanding the language in order to be assigned to that position. If I didn't get it, they changed the assignment. They would give up on you.
Yeah, yeah. So the pressure was on in 10 months to get to a 3+, which is not easy to do. So you were there from 1974 to 1978. So this is the end of Gerald Ford, the beginning of Jimmy Carter, very different presidential administrations. Being there in Warsaw as the administrations change, does that change the nature of your work day to day?
Not really, because at least in those years, would that we had such years again sometime, foreign policy began at the high water mark of our own border. We had general bipartisan agreement on what our foreign policy would be overseas. And so what was important was these were the years immediately before Solidarity and Lech Wałęsa burst forth on the scene in Warsaw, in Poland.
The U.S. government and you personally also were working closely with essentially a shadow government in Poland. You know, again, this is at the height of the Cold War, or the depths of the Cold War, perhaps, and some very intense moments between the Americans and the Soviets, and Poland was really at the center of it. Who was this shadow government, and who was the head of it?
The head of the shadow government was the Cardinal Archbishop of Krakow, later to become Pope John Paul II. John Paul II had a council of advisors that mirrored identically the functions of any government. So they had a senior person for the economy, for diplomacy, for culture, for information. And they met regularly in Krakow under the auspices of the Cardinal Archbishop.
Not too long in the future, he was going to become the Pope.
He was going to. That was an earth-shattering event. No one suspected that this white smoke would billow forth in Rome, and the announcement would be that there was a Polish Pope.
I also recall you telling me that you were there at the celebration of the American bicentennial in Poland as well, and I think that's an interesting example of why we do public diplomacy and how it can have a positive impact on our relations overseas.
We did an exhibit to celebrate the bicentennial based on the time period between the birth of Franklin and the death of Jefferson. And we proposed to mount that exhibit in the National Gallery in Warsaw. The Poles came back and said, if you do that, we will do a companion exhibit of all the artifacts based on Franklin and Jefferson that we have here in Poland. So the National Museum had two absolutely magnificent exhibits going on at the same time. The text for the days of Franklin and Jefferson ran to 35,000 words, all translated into Polish and laid out in the National Museum. As soon as we had a series of banners hanging from the ceiling of the museum with slogans from our revolution, give me liberty or give me death, don't tread on me. And I noticed that people began to write them down on whatever they had carried in to the museum with them so they'd be able to remember these quotations. And we got permission from the museum director to print up these slogans and hand them out to people as they came in.
And this might sound like, so, you know, public diplomacy, having a celebration for the American bicentennial, fairly vanilla, not at all controversial. But this is actually, in the way that you describe it, this is, in its own way, a radical act. I mean, to send the message in the height of the Cold War to the Polish population that, you know, these were the key, sort of the key phrases from the American Revolution as we celebrate it, and to have them take it down in Polish and walk out just at the time that solidarity is on the rise, that's pretty radical.
It was amazing. The impact was beyond anything we expected. We opened in the fall. Winter comes early in Poland, so it was cold and raining, if not snowing, and thousands of people were lining the streets waiting to get into the National Museum to see this exhibit.
Well, we will go on to talk about another place where public diplomacy and American diplomacy in general faced many challenges, and that is South Africa in our next episode.
Thanks much.
I'm Jim Ketterer, speaking with Ambassador Robert R. Gassende about his career in the Diplomatic Corps in a special six-part series for the Roundtable on WAMC. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the U.S. Foreign Service.